This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, are you a rebel with a cause? A psychologist tells us how to dissent with principle and how that can serve to move societies forward. Now, long COVID is estimated to affect up to a third of all Americans who have ever contracted COVID-19. The exact number is unknown, but millions of people are experiencing the often debilitating symptoms of long COVID, which can include cognitive impairment, difficulty breathing, dizziness, fevers, autoimmune disorders, and more. WPR reporter Madeline Fox talked to Wisconsin teenagers who are suffering the effects of long COVID. Here's 17-year-old Rowan Wilson of Watertown, who got COVID in December of 2020.
Every time I would get one new symptom under control, another thing would come up. And I'm like, I've never dealt with this before. What is this? This is awful. I can't handle this. And it would just take over my life.
We're talking about long COVID, what we do and don't know about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or your loved ones have long COVID? When did you realize something was wrong? What are your symptoms? What's it been like to live with this new chronic illness? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Madeline Fox is WPR's K-12 education reporter. She published a story about teenagers in Wisconsin coping with long COVID. Maddie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
You talked to two Wisconsin teenagers. Rowan, we heard there also. Ava, what kind of stories did you hear from them about what they're experiencing with long COVID?
I mean, I think that the clip from Rowan really gets at a big part of it, which is that it's just one thing after another. Both Rowan and Ava talked about, you know, first starting to realize that their case of COVID was not going to be over in the expected, you know, couple or few weeks. And then it was just an ongoing series of new and different symptoms. Some of them were really weird. You know, Rowan talked about full body itching, which was just really miserable. Ava has actually had some complications she's got a disorder where her body doesn't really make cortisol anymore. And that her doctors think came out of her long COVID diagnosis.
Why did you want to look specifically at teenagers who are dealing with long COVID?
Part of it is that I talk to kids. I mean, that's a big part of my job. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of conversations about what kids are missing in the pandemic. And we've seen, you know, really, really steep costs to students not being able to go into their school buildings, to missing milestones. But I think it's also important to think about what the consequences of this disease can be. And I was just so interested in how that affected kids in Wisconsin, teenagers in Wisconsin.
With long COVID, and we'll talk to a guest about this in a bit, there's, I think, still a lot of mystery surrounding it, a lot of uncertainty about what symptom matches it, that sort of thing. Did you get a sense that apart from feeling bad, that uncertainty, that mystery was a big problem for Rowan and for Ava?
Absolutely. One of the frustrations that Rowan talked about was that doctors couldn't give him a lot of information, right? I mean, both of the teenagers talked about their doctor's saying like, oh, that's interesting. Oh, I've never seen that before, which is really not something you want to hear from your doctors. But yeah, I think just the frustration of knowing that something was wrong and having a sense of where it came from, right? COVID-19, but not necessarily being able to articulate why it was wrong in this particular way or explain to their friends or their family members exactly what it was like to be living through that and what that meant in terms of, you know, things that they couldn't do anymore. Or, you know, Ava, for example, has to take medication really regularly. If she's not hydrating religiously, that has really bad consequences for she gets exhausted. And so just sort of fumbling their way through both trying to understand this and trying to explain it when they just don't have very much information.
Maddie, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
Madeline Fox is WPR's K-12 education reporter. You can read her story on Wisconsin teenagers dealing with long COVID. It's up at WPR.org. Now we're taking a look at some of the leading theories about what is actually happening in the body when someone develops long COVID. Dr. Jason Goldman is an infectious disease physician at Swedish Medical Center in Seattle. He's co-author of a recent study on risk factors that can contribute to long COVID. Dr. Goldman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on the call.
Before we get into that study I just mentioned, Dr. Goldman, where are we? Where is the medical community now on kind of defining what long COVID is and how prevalent it is?
That's a great question, Rob. It, as you've mentioned, long COVID can affect up to a third of patients. I think that's a pretty good estimate. We saw that in a, you know, a large study, you know, looking at more than 200,000 people, it was roughly a third had symptoms that persisted to greater than 3 months. Some of the other, you know, medical studies that have kind of amalgamated lots of different smaller trials find an even higher rate. But I think a third of people who experience SARS-CoV-2 infection are going to have some, you know, remaining symptoms. And, you know, as we're aware, the symptoms are really quite numerous. And, you know, as Rowan was experiencing one thing after the other, that's what I'm seeing in my clinic as well. Patients are just having lots of different grab bag of symptoms. It's a sort of a laundry list. And some can come and some can go. And they affect really all major organ systems. So we're still defining it and what types of symptoms, you know, do get better over time, you know, versus what might be kind of persistent for even longer. But I think the medical community has really acknowledged this as a major public health problem.
Now, your co-author, as I mentioned, on a study, it came out last week about things that might make someone more likely to develop long COVID in the first place. What kind of things did you find in this research?
So in our study, we did a deep dive into the biology of long COVID, and we looked at around 200 patients in one cohort and then a sort of a validation cohort in a totally separate 100 patients. And we assessed, you know, their status at the time of acute infection and then again later at about 2 to 3 months after acute infection. And we had, you know, all the patient-reported outcomes, so we know who really who developed long COVID. And what we found were really four major risk factors that when present at the beginning, at the acute infection, could predict who might go on to develop long COVID. And those four things were, one, autoimmunity. That's where the body makes sort of antibodies that attack itself. It's in conditions like lupus, we see autoantibodies. The second thing was the presence of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, you know, genetic material in the blood at the time of acute infection. That does track with severity, but that also predicted long COVID. And we also saw another virus called Epstein-Barr virus, or EBV, which is the virus that causes mono. Also, when that was present in the blood, it predicted long COVID. And the last thing was diabetes.
So you just named some really common conditions. A lot of people have diabetes. A lot of people, whether they've been sick with mono or not, have Epstein-Barr virus, right? That means a lot of people are going to be vulnerable to long COVID?
Well, that's really what we're seeing, Rob. You know, a third of people who develop SARS-CoV-2 infections are going to have some, at least one or more persistent symptom. And, you know, we know that, you know, there's really been 79 million Americans who have been infected with this virus so far. So that's really millions and millions of Americans who have either experienced long COVID in the past or are still experiencing it. So it's very common.
What are some of the theories out there right now about what causes long COVID? Why the effects persist after that initial acute infection?
Yeah, so our study and some other you know, recent papers have really been starting to uncover the biology here. And one of the leading theories is about autoimmunity. So, you know, autoimmunity is, you know, it's what causes type 1 diabetes, but also conditions like lupus and other conditions, you know, that are sometimes have some of the same symptoms like the chronic fatigue and joint pains and other things like that. So there's a well-documented literature now about the development of autoantibodies after COVID, but also people who have autoantibodies, which might be kind of subclinical or not apparent before COVID, it might get exacerbated by COVID. So that's really one of the leading hypotheses. Another very intriguing hypothesis is about the persistence of virus or the persistence of viral antigen. And what I mean by that is if there's little bits or parts of the virus that are sticking around in the body, that might also stimulate inflammation. And there was a recent study done by the National Institutes of Health. It's not peer reviewed yet, but it was recently released, and it studied patients who died of COVID and looked at persistence of virus in the tissues, and it really found extensive evidence for persistence, even in patients who die of COVID, you know, many weeks out from the initial infection. So I think those really two stories, in my view, are going to be driving what we're going to be, you know, learning more about in long COVID and what kinds of interventions we're going to develop to try to address this major problem.
We're talking to Dr. Jason Goldman, infectious disease physician, co-author of a new paper on risk factors associated with long COVID. Coming up, we'll look at what those different ideas might mean about treatment of long COVID. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When we talk about long COVID, are we talking about you or someone in your family? Did you have COVID-19 and are still feeling a weird array of symptoms months later, a year later? Have you found anything that helps your symptoms? If you're a care provider, have you seen patients dealing with long COVID? What kind of things are you seeing? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Dr. Jason Goldman, infectious disease physician at Swedish Medical Center in Seattle, co-author of a new study on the risk factors for long COVID. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experience with long COVID, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Goldman, two ideas there about the causes of long COVID: autoimmune disruption, autoimmune problems, and persistent virus. Do either of both of those point us toward treatments for people dealing with long COVID?
Yeah, thanks, Rob. I think both of those ideas are foundations of how we might treat long COVID in the future. I want to stress, you know, our study and the other recent studies that have been looking at the biology of long COVID don't really point the way right now clearly to treatments that we can use in the clinic today, you know, which is unfortunate because so many people are suffering from this. We do need to kind of take some of these ideas that come out of the biology and test whether treatments will work. But yes, both of those ideas about autoimmunity or persistence of virus, both of those could have implications for developing treatments. And specifically, medicines like steroids or other medicines which modulate the immune system are commonly used to treat other autoimmune diseases. And then if there, you know, really truly is the persistence of virus, then an antiviral approach might also have a beneficial effect. But again, I want to stress we're not quite there yet. Mm-hmm. Rob, there's one thing that Madeline mentioned about Ava and how her doctors found low cortisol in the blood. This is very interesting to me because that was also one of the findings in our study. We saw that in patients who were suffering from long COVID, they did have decreased levels of a number of stress hormones, including cortisol and cortisone. And that might be one of the things that is kind of immediately actionable. If a physician can do the test to prove that in their patient, then I do think that patient is likely to, benefit from replacement steroids. So I'd be sure that Ava's doctors are talking with her about that and considering those options.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hello. So I have multiple rheumatological issues. I have antiphospholipid syndrome, which I understand that there are some antiphospholipid antibodies that are seen in COVID patients, as well as cytokine storms, which is something that happens in APS. But I was also diagnosed after having COVID with rheumatoid arthritis. And speaking with people in my group, specifically on Facebook, and talking with the administrator, the group has been around for a long time, but it's tripled in size since the beginning of the pandemic. And a lot of the people are saying that they've been newly diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, And I'm wondering if maybe it's just long COVID that's disguising itself as RA, or
interesting.
You know, are there ties to that?
Tim, thanks for the call. Dr. Goldman, is that something you've been seeing?
Yes, we've seen quite a number of people with joint complaints, some of whom have really objective evidence, like fluid in the joints. And in some studies, there was one meta-analysis done recently that's a combination of other different studies. Up to 19% of people who, quote, recovered from COVID had persistence of joint pains. So I think this is definitely one of the features of long COVID. And again, I don't think we've really pinpointed for specific symptoms what might be the specific biology underlying those symptoms. We're still at a very general, phase where we're kind of aware of some risk factors, which predict, long COVID, which, like I've mentioned, is kind of a grab bag of lots of different individual conditions.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. We are talking to Dr. Jason Goldman, Swedish Medical Center infectious disease physician, looking at long COVID, possible causes, possible consequences, and cures. Back to your calls now. George is with us in Ashland. George, hi.
Hi. My question is this. There's a rather large group of people who have suffered COVID who are fully vaccinated and boosted. And so what I'm wondering is whether their vaccination status makes them any more or less likely among those who have suffered COVID. Does it make the vaccinated any more or less likely to experience long COVID? Is there any information on that?
Interesting question. Dr. Goldman, do we know yet?
Thanks, George. That is a great question. There have been a number of studies which have tried to address this very question. What we're talking about is whether patients who are vaccinated and develop SARS-CoV-2, i.e. if they get vaccine breakthrough infections, whether or not they develop long COVID or whether it's at the same rate. And the jury's still a little bit out on this one. There was two, pretty good studies that that I've accessed, one of which looked at patient-reported symptoms through like an app. And that one showed that, the long COVID was reduced by about half in those patients. So that's good news. The other study looked at a medical claims database and up to, 10,000 patients who developed breakthrough infections. And in that study, there was no reduction in the incidence or the development of long COVID. So I think we're still at a point where we're not sure about the answer to this. But I think from what we can extrapolate from other conditions and other viral infections, I do think vaccination is going to be really important in reducing long COVID. So I tend to, kind of agree with that study that showed that it's likely to reduce it, but potentially not fully.
Thanks for the call, George, and the question. Tom joins us now in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'd like to ask the doctor, for those COVID patients who previously were diagnosed with autoimmune diseases after COVID, are those autoimmune diseases that they had prior to COVID infection, are those exacerbated?
Dr. Goldman, you mentioned that people with those autoimmune disorders are more vulnerable to long COVID. Do their existing autoimmune conditions get worse after COVID?
Thanks, Tom. I'm not 100% sure about that one. I think we have seen some anecdotal evidence of that. But in terms of, kind of population level evidence, I don't really know if that's a feature that's very common. But I've certainly seen a number of cases of that. And we've also seen, cases of new onset autoimmune processes after COVID. So I think all of the data together, really does suggest that autoimmunity is a major feature in COVID and in long COVID. But specifically on your question of whether autoimmune conditions are exacerbated, I'm not entirely sure.
Thanks for the call, Tom. We had a question. I don't know if the data will be here on this yet either. Maddie and DePere wanted to know if different variants have different long COVID outcomes, Alpha, Delta, Omicron, and so on.
Not sure about that. question either. I think, you know, it's probably still a little too early to know if Omicron is going to have the same prevalence of long COVID, because we're just, you know, kind of getting out of that wave now and not quite at the point, you know, 2 to 3 months out where we're going to really be, you know, diagnosing long COVID. That variant was interesting in that it definitely seemed to have more vaccine breakthrough cases, but less severe cases, more kind of upper respiratory illnesses, but less pneumonias. You know, that said, you know, plenty of people developed very severe COVID from Omicron just because so many people were infected. But overall, it was thought to be a less severe, you know, variant than some of the previous ones. And, you know, when we have fewer patients winding up on a ventilator, I do think we're going to see less long COVID. But again, the jury's still out on that one because it was so recent.
In our last minute or so, Dr. Goldman, still a lot to know about long COVID. What is the number one pressing question in your mind?
The pressing questions are to further develop these ideas of what's causing that and to associate very specific symptoms of long COVID with the underlying biology. And that's going to be the foundation for clinical studies that will assess treatments. The National Institutes of Health is running a very large nationwide trial that will enroll more than 17,000 patients to study long COVID. And a lot of answers are going to be coming out of the study, you know, in the coming months and years.
Dr. Goldman, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Dr. Jason Goldman, an infectious disease physician at Swedish Medical Center in Seattle, co-author of a recent study on risk factors that may contribute to long COVID. He talked to us today about what we know about long COVID and what researchers are still trying to figure out. Wisconsin had more than 300 homicides last year. That's a 70% increase from 2019. Law enforcement agents say there are too many guns on the streets. Some politicians are using the deaths as talking points. Corrine Hess has more.
Torando Long used to spend his mornings taking long walks around his Kenosha neighborhood. His sister, Ramonda Thomas, says exercise brought him joy. Long turned 28 on Valentine's Day, 2021. For his birthday, his mom and sister gave him new workout clothes and a pair of headphones. He was wearing the gifts the next morning when he was shot 3 times in the stomach during his daily walk. Thomas believes her brother thought he was being asked for directions.
He always walked early in the day. It's never like late at night or anything like that, so I don't think he worried about anything.
Long's death was Kenosha's first homicide of 2021. The city ended the year with 16 murders, up from 6 in 2019. That increase was reflected statewide. Kenosha police believe Long was a victim of mistaken identity when he was gunned down. Kenosha's interim police chief, Eric Larson, says guns have become the fallback in arguments leading to more deaths.
And we've seen that in many circumstances, whether it be at taverns, on the street, all these different locations, including some of the domestics.
For Thomas, her brother's death changed the way she thinks about her hometown.
We know now that we can't like live in a world where you can go anywhere and be anywhere at any time because you can be walking down the street and get killed at 9 in the morning. Then you're not really safe.
Wisconsin had 315 homicides last year. About 200 of those were in Milwaukee County. And this year is already off to a deadly start. By February 22nd, Milwaukee County had already seen 38 homicides. Last year's 38th homicide was recorded on April 11th. Some politicians, now in the throes of campaigning, are turning the statistics into talking points. Milwaukee's acting mayor, Cavalier Johnson, would like to see a portion of the state's $2.9 billion budget surplus used to address Milwaukee's challenges with public safety. But that's unlikely. Governor Tony Evers says he has directed $45 million in COVID federal aid to local governments for public safety. He pushed the issue to the Republican-led legislature and called for an increase to shared revenue payments to municipalities.
We've had great trouble with the Republicans getting shared revenue increased in the state. That's the money that those municipalities use to do their work, including fire and police protection.
But some people have felt desperate and lacked confidence in police. That's why University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee criminologist Theodore Lentz says he would have been surprised if there had not been an increase in violence in the last 2 years.
We kind of had the perfect storm. We had the COVID-19 pandemic. And when you couple that with the massive amount of social unrest that we had with the protests and, you know, additional incidents, police shootings and things like that, that just kind of kept that sparks thriving.
Criminologists like Lentz don't have an exact answer about why the crime wave of the 1990s slowed, and they don't know what will make this spike in homicides go down.
It's thinking too about, well, you know, who's at the highest risk for violence? You know, if we see some positive changes, are they part of that positive change?
Back at the Thomas home, Long's memory lives on in photos scattered across the living room.
He was really big in our family because, you know, he was the firstborn.
It's a February afternoon, but the family's Christmas tree is still up. Thomas says her brother loved the holiday.
He came and wrapped all of our gifts. We kind of hold on to that.
Homicides are trending up this year again. And unless something changes, there will be even more families like this across Wisconsin trying to keep memories like these alive. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, do you get along to get ahead at work or in life? Do you try not to make waves, or are you willing to rock the boat? Our next guest says we should be more willing to be the odd one out and raise questions about the way we do things. Without rebellion, without questioning, without dissent, he says society stagnates. We don't move forward. But he also says people who take on that role can get a bad rap, and that can keep others from doing the good work of principled insubordination. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does this sound like you? Are you the one at the workplace, at the committee meeting, whatever it might be, who raises concerns, questions why you do things the way you do them? Do you get a good response when you do that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Todd Kashdan is a professor of psychology at George Mason University in Northern Virginia and an expert on the psychology of well-being, psychological strengths, mental agility, and social relationships. His new book is called The Art of Insubordination, How to Dissent and Defy Effectively. Todd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, so great to be here.
Why do we need insubordinate people? Why do we need these principled insubordinates?
I think you only have to look at history to know the importance of having someone that dissents from popular sentiments at the time. You go back to the Victorian era, and every book that was a bestseller was about etiquette, and everyone talked about family, and the idea of having a romantic relationship because you were in love was absurd. And then Sigmund Freud pops on the scene and says, you know what? Romance is one of the fundamental reasons why men engage in creative pursuits. And then you've got Martin Luther King and Malcolm X that are saying, you know what? There's no reason that if you're black, you should be treated differently than someone that's white. And then you've got 10 years of revolution. And then all of a sudden you move from, you can be in the military and give up your life and 10 years, but you can't publicly reveal that you're not heterosexual. And 10 years later, you end up having gay marriage is acceptable. You dissenters speed up the evolution of norms in society.
You write, though, that it isn't just being a rebel without a cause, rejecting authority for authority's sake. You throw that word principled in subordination. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, the fundamental part of that is this your authentic, genuine value system, or is it because you're looking to get likes and approval by the groups that you're a member of or aspire to be a part of? A lot of people, they're saying something publicly that they don't even believe in. It's actually one of the hardest things about living in society, particularly America right now, is the media gives you an idea what is the popular common belief, but it's often those barroom conversations, those barbecues around the fire pit where the real story is told. And because of that, we don't often understand that most people tend to be very good critical thinkers and really don't believe in the extremes of any of these political parties. And most people are very rational and think about their family's income, the price of gas, the price of food, and make sure that they're not paying more taxes than they need to. And most people who are Democrat or Republican tend to be very similar in their viewpoints.
This isn't an easy role to pursue. And you talk about in the book, people being persecuted in some point at some points in history for dissenting, at the very best being maybe ostracized within their social group or ignored. Your book is a cookbook. You describe it of how to do this, how to dissent in whatever your group is in a way that can actually make a difference. What are some of the main points that we want to start with? I think something's going wrong, say in my organization, I want to bring it up. How do I start?
Great. So if you're talking about your organization, even if it's your family business, the number one strategy that I would say is what I call idiosyncrasy credits. This is from 1967. It's the idea that over the time that you're working in an organization, you do the dirty work. You get lunch for people, you go to the meetings, you are part of committees, and you build up currency over the course of time that shows you're a good team member, such that you now have something you can spend when you disagree with where the organization is going or how an authority member or a team member is treating you or someone else. So you build up what's called idiosyncrasy credits, which means that now you can deviate from the group because you've already established with the track record that you can do something. And when you first share an idea that deviates from everyone else and is going to potentially shock or intrigue people, you want to make a note to remind everyone that here are the things you've done, here are your years of service, here's your commitment to the group. Show your tattoo of the logo of the company on your left tricep. And then when you do the reveal about what you think is going wrong or where you should go, people are like, oh, okay, I'm going to trust Jane or Jack because, listen, they're one of us. You want to establish you're one of the group, you're not an outsider.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jennifer is with us in Madison. Jennifer, hi.
Hi there. As soon as you started describing this, I knew you were talking about me. I have been called a wrecking ball. I've been called a firecracker. I'm not sure whether it's part of my neurodivergence but I kind of say that I was born without chill. And I am always looking to really refine ideas. And that can be, from anybody from, someone who would be my political nemesis, somebody who's across the table from me, or somebody who is cooperative, somebody who I want us all to do better. And I've often remarked that it's a difficult place to be, especially as a woman. In this society, but I can't do anything else. This is somehow I was born this way, the same way other people maybe were born to be people pleasers. And I haven't found really that people find it too abrasive. Obviously, some people do, but I think most people see that my heart's in the right place.
Jennifer, I got to ask, how did you cultivate that? How do you convey that your heart's in the right place so you're not just, getting in fights with people?
How I'm not just bulldozing people? one of the ways that I do that is that I engage in a lot of charitable acts. I raise money for people who are in bad situations. I do a lot of building up of other people as well, and a lot of just emotional support of people. I think that's really important these days. And so I try, are you there?
Oop, your line's breaking up a little bit, Jennifer, but you gave us a lot to work with, Todd. I mean, Jennifer could have been a chapter in your book, I think.
No, Jennifer, I'm so glad that you called in first because, first of all, when we think about someone that's a principled rebel, the typical thing is to imagine a male who's loud and assertive and not a woman. So this is your superpower, Jen. This is your strength. I'm actually going to give a phrase to actually describe what you are. You are a counterpoint, which is when the group is going in one direction, you recognize, you pause, take a deliberate pause and say, you know what? I care about the health and longevity of this group so much so that I'm willing to put skin in the game and risk my reputation and my stress level because I want to share something that I think we could do even better and we can actually be stronger because of it. And one thing you heard that Jennifer says is that, and you can see from the inflection of her voice, like she cares. And that's a very important thing we have to remember. Most principled dissenters, they're not doing it because they're trying to gain power. They're doing it because the group matters so much to them. And one of the important things that she said was, is that if you observe her behavior and ignore her words, you're going to see, oh, this is a virtuous person. This is somebody I want my side, even though she's going to cause a little bit of tension in the air because she's going to disrupt the harmony and the positivity of the group and make us inefficient in the short term, because she's going to make us think about innovative ideas that will help us in the long term.
Jennifer, thanks for that call. We're talking to psychology professor Todd Kashdan about his new book, The Art of Insubordination, How to Dissent and Defy Effectively. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you caused more or less of a stir over time in your workplace or wherever? Have you stood your ground in a maybe a workplace meeting or something like that where you were going against the prevailing wisdom? How did it go? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with George Mason University psychology professor Todd Kashdan. His new book is called The Art of Insubordination, How to Dissent and Defy Effectively. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Good afternoon. I'm a Green Bay Packers shareholder, and over 20 years ago, I stood up at a Packers shareholder meeting in front of 18,000 people, and I disagreed with what Reggie White was saying before the Wisconsin State Legislature about gay marriage and the gay agenda and stuff. I encouraged Bob Harlan and the Packer organization to distance themselves from Reggie White's comments because he doesn't represent the Packers when he speaks. But the prevailing opinion among Packer shareholders and the administration was that, well, he has a right to his opinion, but he was using Packer uniform, Packer stationery and communication and stuff. And I was vindicated 2 weeks after the shareholder meeting because the Packers eventually apologized to the NFL and the Human Rights Campaign and did distance themselves from what Reggie White was saying. But I took a lot of flack right away.
Did you feel nervous getting in front of a bunch of Packer fans and saying, hey, distance yourself from a future Hall of Famer?
Well, I love Reggie White. He prayed for me, and I'm no longer in that lifestyle. So I think the irony is he did change my life. But I'm glad I stood up and spoke from my heart because I love the Packers more than I love anything else, really.
Jeff, thanks a lot. Let's take that last point there, Todd. He loves the organization, so he's willing to criticize it in that moment.
That's right. And here's the thing is Jeff was really clear that he was going to sacrifice his psychological well-being for the care and concern of the group and the notion of for one individual to say that their moral views represent this entire heterogeneous group of people. Jeff said, no, like you don't represent all of us. We are a diverse number of people that's here. And he had a problem with that. I think there should be more Jeffs in the world. It doesn't matter whether you agree with Jeff on the issue. What's important about it, about dissenters that we know, is if even if the dissenter is wrong, just the fact that a Jeff says something means that everyone thinks about, huh, what's the evidence for the view that I'm holding deeply onto? What's the evidence for the other side? And what have I not considered? Even if they disagree with Jeff on that day, as he mentioned, a few days later, he was vindicated. And this is something that's really important. You might know ahead of time that in the immediate mention of your dissenting idea, probably people disagree with you and dig their heels, but you've gotten a little bit of a message into their brain, a little tiny worm that entered their brain, which is, you know what? There's another way of looking at this, another vantage point, and it makes people more creative in their decision making.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Walt joins us now in Fort Atkinson. Walt, hi.
Good afternoon. It's an interesting topic. So I've got you on speaker. I think this will work.
Yeah,
I just wanted you to get to comment on the concept of the first follower and the importance of the first follower. There was a video that was popular on YouTube a year or two ago, and it showed an outdoor concert, and this guy got up and started dancing out in the lawn on the grass, and he was dancing wildly, and he was kind of scared everybody because he was so crazy. But then another guy got up and started dancing and broke that ice, And pretty soon, half of the entire crowd was out dancing to this thing. And it, the importance of the first follower validating the leader was the topic of that.
Interesting. Walt, thanks for the call. We don't have too much time left. Todd, the first follower idea.
Walt is speaking of a very interesting video that everyone should watch. There's the myth of the lone genius. Is you can't do this alone. Your voice has to be amplified by finding people that are going to be in your alliance and coalition. It's the first thing you should do in an organization. If you're Jeff and you're an organization, if you're Jen, where she's just a firecracker, find other people, because when you speak your message as a consistent whole unit, it is harder to immediately dismiss you, and your ideas have to at least be given a fair hearing. And all you could ask for as a minority voice of not having the numbers or power is that you get a fair hearing and people consider your message. You need that alliance.
Thanks for that call, Walt. I want to flip things around, as you do in your book, Todd, and talk about how organizations can be more dissent friendly, because they can get a lot of value out of it.
Yeah, there's a couple things that are important. One, the leader should always speak last and preferably never give their opinion in public on the issue that people are debating. The best strategies that we know are not brainstorming sessions, which is what most organizations do, but have people anonymously write down their ideas so that when people look at the ideas, the messages, they're not attaching it to how much you like the messenger. And in this way, the newcomer, the only Black person in an organization, the women in the organization, the people that are physically unattractive in the organization and aren't cool, quote unquote cool in the organization, their ideas are treated with just as much merit as those people who are socially attractive and with power. And another idea that's important is that you should clarify in an organization that the goal of trying to make a decision as a group is not to be harmonious or have cohesion and feel good about yourselves. There's always time for happy hour later. When you're working together, critical thinking, independent thinking, and having a little bit of healthy skepticism, encourage it, incentivize it, and make sure people share their criticisms while you're in the room and not having the small little breakout sessions where people are talking smack after the meeting happens.
All right, 30-second drill. I'm in a meeting. Somebody's raising concerns about the organization. I feel defensive and uncomfortable about it. How do I shake that and give them a fair hearing?
One of the most important things is to what's called self-distancing, which is that you imagine that the regret of not considering idea, your future self, will be more upset than the regret of actually being embarrassed that you chose the wrong direction by listening to someone. We should always try to imagine what would we think 1 year from now if we didn't give this idea a chance, because we know that the world is constantly changing. We know there's constant flux. So we have to remind ourselves to expand the time horizon and not think just about our immediate defensive reaction, but that we know that we don't want to be the next Kodak. We don't want to be the next Blockbuster. We don't want to be the next Beanie Baby. And so in order to prevent that from happening, we have to have a reservoir of new ideas that come into our possession. We play with them. We tinker with them. We explore them. And maybe we throw them out. But we have to bring those ideas into the resource center.
Todd, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here.
That's Todd Kashdan, psychologist at George Mason University. His new book is The Art of Insubordination, How to Dissent and Defy Effectively. This is the Ideas Network.